Osiris.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
I am Allison Russell, and I am sitting in my office slash Zoom room in our first ever home of our own in East Nashville, Tennessee. I'm a transplant from Montreal, Quebec, Canada here, and I try to be a good mom, and I'm a musician, and I'm a new author in the midst of writing my first book, and I try to reduce harm in the world and be kind. I guess that's me in a nutshell.
That was a way more complete answer than most people give. I appreciate that. I like to consider myself an early Allison adopter.
Yes, absolutely. Obviously, and I'm an early Zach adopter.
Have you considered running for office?
No. No, I don't want to do that.
I would vote for you.
Oh, you're so sweet, Zach. But I think that my gifts, such as they are, I don't know that it's my the only thing I can do, the only thing I have, are my words and melodies, and hopefully that can. I think that all artists are ultimately radical empathy workers, and we are needed right now more than ever. And I think that this country, not just this country, but this is the country I'm living in now. My home country is in the same state, and a lot of the globe is in the same state, but we are suffering from empathy impairment, really severe empathy impairment, to the point that we are gonna drive ourselves into mass extinction if we can't figure out how to value one another as fully equal human beings, and how to listen to one another, and how to creatively problem solve together.
Well, hello again, everybody. Welcome to season 4 of the Show on the Road podcast. I'm very happy to bring you some new episodes live from my sequined podcast nook as the dog snores behind me and the construction crew bangs right outside the window. I apologize if it's not as pristine as some other fancy podcasts, but I'm lucky enough to bring you one of my favorite singer-songwriters in the world for our first episode, the bodacious, bilingual, banjo-toting goddess Allison Russell. You know, every now and again, good things happen to really good, talented people. Yes, many people just discovered Allison this year with her breakout solo debut, Outside Child. Slow-boiling, cut-right-to-your-heart root songs like Night Flyer were on every best-of list this year, including President Obama's favorite songs. But as usual, kids, every overnight sensation is about 22 years in the making. Yes, Allison has been working her whole adult life at making amazing music, starting in Canada with the group Po Girl, then with Birds of Chicago and her lovely husband JT in Nashville, and then joining the super group Our Native Daughters. And this year, her debut solo record is nominated for 3 Grammys. And why does this matter? Am I trying to say that maybe persistence and hard work can pay off every now and again? I don't know. Maybe. But as you'll hear in our conversation, Allison has come from the hardest of beginnings. And the reason her record, Outside Child, struck a nerve with so many people, she does not turn away from the abuse she suffered as a child. She faces it head on. And the scary thing is, she's definitely not alone. 1 in 9 girls under the age of 18 experience sexual abuse or assault at the hands of an adult as they're growing up. 82% of all victims under 18 are girls. What's more, the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence says that on average, nearly 20 people per minute are physically abused by an intimate partner in the United States alone. So, as we embark on this new season where I get to talk to amazing songwriters from around the world, I ask you one thing, please. Listen to the lyrics. Listen to what these creators are saying. And to me, this is more than music. Anyway, thank you for supporting this podcast. Please leave us a kind review and share it with your friends. If you want to support this podcast financially, you can be an awesome person. Go under the text of this episode and see the support link there. In case you're wondering, my group Dust Bowl Revival will be playing a big show at the Wiltern in LA, March 31st, opening for the infamous String Dusters. Okay, enough of me going on. Here she is now, Allison Russell. Well, I remember talking backstage at the 9:30 Club with JT, and you guys played with Dust Bowl Revival, and that was kind of right as the world was about to shut down. But he had this like little like light in his eye when he talked about this project that he was working on with you. Like he's like, you know, just you wait. You know, and again, it takes so long for art and this type of stuff to gestate. I mean, these are songs that have been probably fermenting in your brain since you were a kid. Yeah. A lot of this is about the trauma you experienced, the escape from that, the processing of the trauma.
Yeah.
And it's not like you maybe haven't touched on it in Birds of Chicago songs, but it's very raw and very immediate in these songs. It's not hidden behind 3 or 4 verses. It's right at the top of some of these songs, like Fourth Day Prayer.
No, it's true. I mean, it's a lifetime for sure of processing, and for me, art and trauma are closely connected. Slept in the graveyard under the mud when the sun came up and found my skin. I rose again. It's one for the hate that loops and loops. 2 for the poison and the roots. 3 for the children begging. 4 for the day we're standing inside. Ooh. 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 Art was my escape from trauma. You know, art was my lifeline. It's the reason I'm alive. At all. And you're right, the album is very much about the escape from that situation and breaking the cycle. And that is my family, you know, that my mom is my mom and my adoptive father is my adoptive father. You know, he's the man who raised me and there's nothing I could do to change that. He's also my primary abuser, you know, and I also charged him and he also spent some time in prison because of it. But my mom still lives with him, you know, they are my family. Yeah. And he's also was an abused child, you know. So it's like these intergenerational cycles of abuse and trauma and bigotry and violence don't go away unless we can at least take the first step of facing it all head on and opening our mouths about it. You know, and that was one of the things for me in my own healing. So much of what he did, the physical part, the sexual abuse part, you know, your body heals eventually, but what is much more insidious and much more difficult to recover from, and what I'll probably be unpacking for the rest of my life, is the psychological abuse, you know, the systematic brainwashing over years to try to unmake someone's personhood and make a child feel less than human, you know, which he succeeded in for a long time, but not forever. And that's a big part of why I felt like I needed to sing about my roadmap out, you know, my underground railroad to freedom. And the book that I'm writing is sort of an expansion on what I began on the Outside Child album.
Well, the chorus of Fourth Day Prayer is almost like the full circle, right? Where it starts, one for the hate that loops and loops, two for the poison at the roots. And then it sort of breaks free with the children breaking through, four for the day we're standing in the sun, that there is the possibility of hope. And
I believe there's more than a possibility. I think that that change can happen so quickly. I mean, that's part of what it's a trick. This divide and conquer playbook is an ancient feudal trick. It's like we haven't managed to drag ourselves out of the exploitative, extractive, hierarchical fallacies of the feudal system. Like, we're still trapped in these systems of oppression and enacting these oppressive ideas upon one another and upon our children. You know, but it can change so fast. You know, I think about, in a tiny microcosm way, even what's happening for this record right now, mm-hmm. that is not because of me. That is because of an entire community of fellow artists and people on the other side of the curtain, you know, who are doing incredibly creative work on the label side, on the publicity side, on the distribution side, on the journalism side, on the radio side. Like, this is a whole collective and coalition, a community. The work that we're doing in kind of the broader Americana, all Americana community, to open the door wider and to try and represent more of this full spectrum of artists, you know, that are out there creating. And I am being uplifted by that community. And this album was uplifted by that community and the incredible village that helped me make it and that are amplifying it out into the world. You know, even my wonderful label, Fantasy Records. I mean, we hear so many horror stories about labels, but I have a dream story. You know, it's a label run by women and queer folks and all, you know, all like a very diverse executives that work at Fantasy and at the greater Concord family, who saw me and valued me as an artist and who supported me as an artist and lifted our family out of poverty in the middle of a pandemic. You know, it's like, you can make, we've all made beautiful records, like, for 22 years, some of us. You know, I'm 42 years old. I've been doing this professionally for 22 years. I've been making records I'm proud of with Poe Girl, with Birds of Chicago, with Our Native Daughters, you know, for a long time. And nothing like this has ever happened before. And I think that it's sort of a conjunction of, you know, the incredible, that community building over the last 22 years. You know, the reason I even know Fantasy Records or met them was because of, I reached out to Brandi Carlile, and we didn't know each other particularly well. We had, like, done the Edmonton Folk Fest together and the Camo Cruise when our girls were tiny babies, and we ran into each other on the beach, and Evangeline and Ida said, hi, you know, Evangeline was 6 months old, so she couldn't speak yet. I think Ida said, hi, baby, and, you know, that was it. We didn't know each other. I reached out during the lockdown. I reached out to her on Instagram. Like, I DM'd her thinking, oh, she's never going to see that. And her wife, Catherine, found it, and they listened to the demo I sent. And then, you know,
like a true hustler,
started blowing up my phone saying they loved it. And then Brandi just, you know, got really, she chose to champion it and to make some calls on my behalf. And she had an intuition about that I should meet Margie Chesky, who's the head of a Fantasy and Stax and Vanguard within the Concord family group.
Yeah.
And that, you know, she had worked with Margie and Steph and the whole Fantasy team on Tanya Tucker's record that she and Shooter produced. And she loved them, and she thought they're going to get this. And she was right. We recognized one another as kindred spirits, you know?
It took a little cold call hustling, though, right?
Yeah,
it's like sometimes you got to put your faith
in the universe. Because nothing happens if we don't put it out there. And if we don't, and I will say to any artist listening, you know, who's earlier in your arc of trying to get your art out there, really think about who it is that you admire, whose career you would want to emulate. That's
right.
That's Mealy, our rescue dog in the background.
Who's Mealy?
It's a Mealy girl. Yes. She's so good. The axiom of the rescue, she rescued us, of course. But I will say, reaching out to people whose art resonates for you, mm-hmm. and who you admire the way they are running their business, because of course, as professional artists, it's art, but it's also at a certain point, if that is your profession, it's also business. And mm-hmm. then learn, and that's such a painful, it took me years to accept that it was a business, you know? And I frankly ran it very poorly for years because of that.
What's interesting about this record is it feels like almost like a cubist, multi-angle view of these certain traumatic stories and how you moved through it, right? I mean, the second verse of Night Flyer, right? You have the sick light of a hurricane's eye, the violent lullaby.
Six fireflies, one street.
Right. And I'm his shadow in the door frame. I'm each of his steps on the stairway. You embody these moments of intense fear and pain,
yeah.
and you're able to sort of transform them into song, which is kind of what the blues does, right? It's what the blues is all about. The first time I heard...
Taking some autonomy back.
Yeah.
You know? Taking some power back. And the blues is at the heart of every genre of American song, you know, of every modern idiom, essentially, is indebted, heavily indebted, and directly borrowing from the blues. You know, there's no rock and roll without it. There's no jazz. There's no pop. There's no confessional balladry. There's no none of that. You know, like that. We owe huge debt to the blues.
Yeah, I'm a midnight ride, storm bone of fine I fly. I'm an angel of the morning too. Promise that the dawn will be you. Fireflies, one street light, I'm suffocating summoning.
How many instruments do you currently play?
That's
banjo,
a good
clarinet. How
banjo,
many
clarinet,
different ones
ukulele.
Do you use?
I'm really this year I am focusing on piano and bass clarinet because I love the bass clarinet, and my dear friend Levon Henry, who is an incredible reedsman, Joe Henry's son, he's an absolutely brilliant saxophonist and clarinetist and a beautiful burgeoning songwriter as well. Wonderful. He reminds me of Ornette Coleman, the way he plays. He's incredible. But he gave, or I bought his bass clarinet from him during the lockdown. He had a student model that he wasn't using anymore, and I love it so much. And then piano, my daughter Ida is going to start piano this year, and I'm going to start piano lessons with her because I am an illiterate musician. You know, I'm someone who's learned everything by ear, and I've decided my 2022 artistic resolution is to learn to read and write music so that I don't need to always, I have a symphony idea that I want to be able to write down myself instead of humming it to somebody else to do it for me or into an app or anything like that. So piano, and next I play Irish frame drum called the boron.
Okay.
I play penny whistles.
Naturally.
Because, you know.
As one does.
Scottish, Grenadian, Canadian. I love the penny whistles. What else do I play? Guitar. Oh, I play guitar. Not well, you know. I play guitar just to write songs here and there. But the banjo is my primary songwriting instrument now, for sure.
Well, I went back and listened to the band that you had in Canada called Po Girl.
Yeah.
And I used to love listening to that in college, I remember.
You did?
Like early mixtape days when you were listening to like old fiddle songs and different things, and like obviously the Be Good Tanyas were around.
Well, so Trish Klein and I formed that band together, and Trish, of course, was one of the three women that founded the Be Good Tanyas, or four really, because Jolie Holland was there in the beginning, but she left early on and started her solo career. And then Frazee Ford, Sam Harton, and Trish, you know, rose to wide acclaim with that group. And I loved them. I learned so much watching them. You know, they're all sort of like 5 to 7 years older than I am. And I really admired them. Like when I moved to Vancouver, I was 17 and I was in the closet as a songwriter and in the closet as a musician still. And Trish and I met each other early on. I moved into this kind of crumbling, dilapidated house, 475 Aubrey Place. There were always, you know, 8 to 10 of us living there at any given time. And she had just sort of moved out when I moved in. But we had these monthly potluck big jam sessions.
Right.
And I met her at one of those. And she was really encouraging of me as a singer and a writer in my early days. So those, and then I remember my first folk alliance where I met JT was in 2001, and I was basically roadieing for the Tanyas. You know, I was just like schlepping gear and checking out the scene. And I'll never forget the first time I heard JT, for those of you listening in Radio Land, JT Nero is the love of my life and my life partner, and we formed Birds of Chicago together, and we made a baby girl named Ida together, who's now 8 years old. And you know, we've been together for 15 years and married for 8 years, and he co-wrote 9 of the 11 songs on my debut solo record, Outside Child. But the first time I heard him was when I was roading for the Tanyas at the 2001 Folk Alliance at the Hyatt Hotel in Vancouver. And I remember hearing JT and his singing partner at the time, Michelle McGrath, in, like, you know, doing a gorilla busking set in the lobby. And I was transfixed. And I thought, I want to make music with him one day. And here we are.
I want to make music and or children with him.
And or children with him. I did not think that yet at the time. I had a lovely girlfriend at that time. But, you know, yes, eventually it became clear that if I was going to make a child, it would be with him.
If you want to hear the story of JT and Allie falling in love, listen to Show on the Road episode with Birds of Chicago. First season, I believe.
That's right. We were your first season. I feel proud that we were part of your
basically
first
in my bedroom closet.
Yeah, that was fun. It was fun because we recorded at your place, and you made us some sort of delicious something. What was it that you cooked? Some delicious thing. Do you remember that? It was like a vegetarian stew, maybe. It was really good.
I don't know if I've ever made a vegetarian stew, but I believe you.
Someone made some delicious thing that we ate at your house.
I was jamming to the song Moving On from Po Girl, Vagabond. Lullabies. I love that song. It's like a front porch jam.
It makes me so happy. I can't believe you unearthed that. That makes me so, so happy.
The wind blows now through the alley. There's the rig at a chicken factory. And South Bronx sang surely. I think we reached that old moving out. You're so sad when I'm away.
There's like crickets going in the background, maybe.
There are, yeah. There are crickets, and there are lines like the smell of the chicken factory, because we lived in the downtown east side of Vancouver, basically, in a neighborhood just adjacent to it called Strathcona. And there was a chicken factory that, when the wind went the wrong way, it just was the most horrific smell
you
can imagine. And yeah, The wind blows low through the alley, bears the reek of the chicken factory. That's one of the lines.
How many songs you think are in your brain right now? Like, how many
so
songs?
So many songs are
stored.
Weirdly, like, I didn't know that I even remembered that song, but as soon as you said it, like, I can hear it. I can hear that recording that we made. You know, just can't seem to get along, and you know we've both been wrong. The time for sorrow is come and gone. I think we reached that on moving up. My friend Ray Spoon sang on that song with us, and oh yeah, that's just a whole era that. And Ray and I briefly had a band called The Dirties. Like, there were all these hysterical layers of just figuring out what, you know, what we were doing and finding your kindred, you know, your kind of philosophical and musical kindred.
Well, I think the Native Daughters project is such a great way for people to learn about Black music from a different angle, right? A lot of people assume that, you know, most Black music is hip-hop or modern soul or funk, and the stuff that started way, way at the beginning with the fiddle, the banjo, and obviously Rhiannon Giddens is at the forefront of saving that music.
Not only
Carolina
saving
Chocolate
it,
Drops and beyond.
Yeah, she's part of an unbroken lineage of it, because she, yeah. You know, Rhiannon and Justin Robinson and Dom Flemons, who were the original lineup of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, yeah. They learned directly from Joe Thompson. And right. Joe Thompson was an unbroken lineage of the Black string band tradition.
When you take your banjo and you start playing a song like Kashiba, right?
Yeah.
Which is telling the story of an enslaved foremother of yours, which you learned from your Grenadian aunt, and you're out on a stage like Carnegie Hall. Right, yeah. You're out on a stage like, you know, Red Rocks. You have the chance to bring this lost history to a lot of people, right? Like, this music that you're creating is American music in its bones, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I talk about America, I have had an interesting thing too of people being, well, you're Canadian, why are you playing Americana? And
North American.
Exactly. Well, and more than that, it's not just North American. It's Caribbean. It's South American. It's Central American. By the way, Mexico's North American too, you know, which people seem to forget. It's like, that's how I think of the evolution of American, quote unquote, music, right? And it's really fascinating. I just met this wonderful historian on Twitter, who is Sam Hasselby is his name, and he is he studies early America, and he specifically is talking about the early Islamic influence in America, which is a huge erased history, because of course many of the enslaved people who were imported were Muslim, and you know, from North Africa, and just hugely influential to all kinds of parts of culture of America. And that has been erased and whitewashed. And he's fascinating. And he talks about that historians now, when they talk about America, early America, geographically, they do the same thing. They talk about from the Caribbean through South, Central, North America. Like, that's the Americas that we're talking about in terms of our history, how it unfolds, how everyone's influencing one another, colliding and crashing into one another. And I have always heard the music that way, too, you know, and have had wonderful discussions, you know, with Rhiannon and Layla and Amethyst about it. And that was so much of what was informing us as we were working on the Songs of Our Native Daughters record that we put out in 2019.
Your children founded generations. Your strength sustained them. They won their freedom, trace their roots to find your way there. Kashiba, Kashiba, you're free now, you're free now. How far your spirits flow. Bloody or black, bloody or black, gotta be the strength we are. Let it up. in the world are the joyful motherfuckers, the fearless lovers, the rainbow shooters, the wild.
In the song Joyful Motherfuckers, you talk about your grandmother saying, like, you know, love will conquer hate, but you don't know if it's too late already, right?
Yeah. I don't think it is.
Do you remember what your grandmother, like, what was the most wise thing your grandmother ever told you?
You know, my grandma, there was so, I don't know if I can pick just one. I mean, I am so indebted to her for, she was, you know, the light of my childhood. She's my Scottish-Canadian grandmother, my mom's mom, Dr. Isabel Roger Robertson. You know, she grew up on a farm with no shoes during the Depression and rode her horse Star to school, and she was a brilliant scholar, and she put herself through her higher education all on scholarships, and did put my grandfather through his higher education while she taught. You know, she taught and paid for him to go, having five kids, and somehow got her PhD and became a fellow at McGill University, and that's why I was born in Montreal. So that's the first gift she gave me. I don't think I would have survived my childhood anywhere else other than Montreal. Montreal is a city built on art and heart. It is, in a, you know, we have the Jazz Fest every year. We have Caravana, which is a celebration of all things Caribbean every year. There's music in the streets. In the summertime, entire streets get shut down and turned into pedestrian streets, and it's just art and people from everywhere. And, you know, the mountain and the Tam Tam Jams. And I slept in the graveyard by the mountain. I mean, I literally was safe there. And I would have maybe not been anywhere else, you know, when I was a runaway teen at 15. And it's, I can't emphasize enough how important that city was to my survival and my evolution as a human being and an artist.
You got love in your heart, but it's way down in the dark. You better let it see the sun. This world is almost done. Grandma always told me love would conquer hate. I don't know if it's too late. I don't know if it's too late. Hey you, hey you, who you think I'm talking to? Show 'em what you got in your heart.
If you could make a movie of your favorite book that transported you as a kid and write the soundtrack, which book would it be?
The Bone People by Carrie Hume. And I want to just send out gratitude to Carrie Hume and her family. She just recently passed away. She is a brilliant Maori New Zealand author. She won, I think was the first New Zealand author to win the Booker Prize for The Bone People. And it's a book that my Uncle David gave me in my childhood. I think I was 11 when he gave me that book. And I have reread it probably every year of my life. And it's a story that helped me survive and that helped me feel seen and recognized, and that there was a possibility of forgiveness and healing and redemption. It's a beautiful book. And if I could, if someone made a movie of that book, and I hope someone does, I would love to be involved in writing the soundtrack. It couldn't just
it
be, because there would definitely need to be Maori musicians involved. You know, it's such a deeply indigenous story to New Zealand, to Aotearoa, the Shining Land. But I would love to be involved. I would love to contribute.
As your world has transformed a bit in the last year since Outside Child has taken off, what has been the most surprising thing? What has been the most amazing thing?
Getting a book deal, which just happened 2 days ago, that has been shocking and stunning. And, you know, and of course,
for
the
fiction?
Surreal. It's a nonfiction. It's a memoir that I'm writing. It's definitely going to grow out of what I've already begun on the Outside Child record. I realized that I had a lot more to say and share. And so I'm about, 100 pages in right now. And I have I just am working with my dream editor, a woman named Bryn Clark, who is a senior editor at Flatiron Books, which is one of the imprints of Macmillan Publishers. And I am so excited to be working with her and working with them. And I, you know, she just edited Tarana Burke's Unbound. She just edited Ashley C. Ford's Somebody's Daughter. Like, she is brilliant. And the authors that she has championed and uplifted are, I think, some of the most important thinkers and writers in the world right now. And so I feel incredibly, I mean, it's a shocking, I can't even believe it. And I'm so excited, you know, to be starting this journey of authorship with them. And so that's the kind of the wildest thing that's come out of Outside Child so far.
But the song Persephone, again, feels like almost a true crime novel happening.
Blood on my shirt, two ribbons, might have killed me that time. Oh, if I'd let him, he's slow and he's drunk, and he lost his grip on me.
Again, you're dropping us into this very tense, dark situation, and it's not like, well, let's ease them into it, right?
No. Blood on my shirt, two
first line, blood on my shirt, two rip buttons. It sounds like a detective writing down a crime and unfolding.
It was a crime unfolding, and I was escaping from it, and she saved my life. You know, Persephone was my first love, my first girlfriend, and she saved my life, plain and simple.
Can you read that first verse and chorus like it's poetry?
Blood on my shirt, two rip buttons, might have killed me that time. Oh, if I'd let him. He's slow when he's drunk, and he lost his grip on me. Now I'm running down La Rue St. Paul, trying to get out from the weight of it all. Can't find a cop, because I know he won't stop. I go see Persephone.
I mean, look, people often don't even listen or read lyrics, right? But there's no way to escape the edge of this knife, right? It's right there. I'm curious if you felt like you were being re-traumatized by having to sing these every night. Is it something that's painful to sing, or is it something that's cathartic?
It's cathartic, and it's interesting. I wondered that myself. Would it be painful? I think the recording of it was the hardest part, because they were very raw new songs when we recorded them. You know, all of these songs were written between July 2019 and September 2019. And in fact, the last one we were finishing in October as we were recording them at the studio. Joyful Motherfuckers was the last song that we finished for the record. And so they were really raw and new. I mean, there was a lot of crying going on in the studio. I would cry and then the band would cry. We were just crying and laughing. And that was joyful and cathartic too in many ways. But it was definitely, that was the most harrowing in a way, just singing them for the first time and sharing them like that with everybody in the studio for the first time. And that was a new thing for me, because with Birds and with Poe Girl, the new songs would always grow up on the road.
Light on your shoulder, light on your cheek, light telling me it's time to leave. The birds are calling to the morning, your parents' feet above us stirring. Kiss your belly before I go, climb back out of your basement window, back to the cold spot, back to the hard light, back to the harsh bright street.
We loved getting to open for y'all at the 9:30 Club. That was fancy, you know. But we were hard touring, and it was working class, small venues, and I wouldn't trade a minute of it. I learned so much from all of that. But the pandemic and the shutdown forced us to rethink everything, and I realized how utterly vulnerable we were when our entire living was predicated upon subsistence touring.
Yeah.
You know, and that when the shows disappeared, like how was I going to provide for how are we going to provide for our child? And both JT and I just dug in on writing that we needed to find more and diverse and less sort of subject to cancellation ways to use our words. And that's, you know, what we both really dug in on throughout 2020 and now into 2021, when I've now just miraculously, you know, a signed author. And we both got signed to Concord Music Publishing last year, toward the end of last year, and that was life-changing. Like, I was excited about that Fantasy wanted to put out Outside Child, but there's no, we all know there's no guarantee with any record, and the sort of vagaries of the pandemic, like, there was no way to know, even if we'd be able to do any touring in 2021. Right. You know, everyone was sort of like, buckle up, we have no idea what's going to happen. But I was incredibly lucky to have a label like Fantasy, who were like, we've got you, we're doing an 18-month campaign, and we're going to get creative with it, because we all have to get creative with everything right now. There's no...
Yeah.
We're reinventing everything as we go. You know, this virus is forcing us to evolve too, you know, and to change and to do things differently and to self-examine. And, you know, we're in the midst of it. I don't think we're going to even understand. We're too close. We're in it. We can't see how we're changing fully. We are not going to know. Probably historians in 20 years will tell us what happened, you know.
Of all your years, and you've played in different countries, you've played around the world, is there one show that sticks out as the most bizarre, the most insane, like possibly dangerous show that you've ever played?
The most dangerous was actually, so there's two things. The most kind of wondrous and outside of anything I had experienced before was the Massau Women's Festival in Douala, Cameroon. Po Girl was so privileged to play. We were one of only two North American bands that got to play it. That was in 2007, the summer of 2007. And we got to play in Paris, and then we flew from Paris to Douala. And when we got there, the festival stages hadn't been built yet. And we thought we were playing the next day. And it was, you know, it was like everybody literally said to us, this is Africa, it'll happen, don't worry. They got us a driver who took us all over Cameroon to these beautiful beaches, to Yaoundé. And we met these incredible women, like this Dovi Kendo, who is a Cameroonian superstar. She was on a very popular soap opera in the Cameroon, but she also started a theater company that she named MLK after Martin Luther King. She was at the forefront of AIDS activism, of HIV awareness, of sex education for women. She's like a first wave feminist in Cameroon, right. And her whole group of just absolute badass lady friends. And we hung with them, and they took us everywhere, and it was my first time not being a visible minority ever in my life. It was incredible. Although I was sort of a minority in that I'm pale for Cameroon. So they would call me La Petite, and I'm not pale. For those of you listening in the audience, nobody in North America would call me pale. Nobody in North America would ever think that I have a white mom. I am, you know, I have dark brown skin and 4C, very textured, curly African diaspora hair. And nobody in North America, definitely not America, where most black folks here that are descended of the enslaved diaspora, are a lot of them are paler than me. So, you know, nobody thinks that I'm anything other than fully black here. But in Cameroon, I was pale there. Right. And they called me La Petite Métisse, which means, you know, the little mixed girl. But it was said with affection. It wasn't said in a derogatory way. And they all also said, you look Cameroonian. And that was in 2007 that we went there. It was magical. We played with this incredible like almost mixing like high life with hip hop, with poetry. She was just brilliant. This woman named Lady B. And I would love to get to work with her again. She was incredible, and we jammed, and we met so many beautiful musicians. We met school children. We were adopted into this community of fierce first wave feminists in Cameroon. It was incredible. It was a life-changing experience. And we were there for a week before the festival happened. And then the festival happened, and it was even more joyful. And I will never forget this one moment. We were going through a checkpoint, on our way back into Douala, which is the capital city in Cameroon. And there was a guy with a gun, and we were all like, oh, we were afraid. This, you know, guy with a huge gun at the checkpoint. And what he, and I thought about our bureaucracy in North America and how hidden the white crime of it is, you know, the white collar right. crime of it. It's so hidden, you know, redlining, preferential loaning so that people of color can't get a loan, or, you know, right. you're trying to sell your house, and if you're a black family, your house is considered to be $500,000 less than if it were yeah. a white family. You know, all these stories that are true that come out that we've had to live, you know, learn and face. Some of us are facing it. Some of us are still in denial. But, you know, this crime that's gone on, you know, you want to talk about looting, like the theft of an entire country from indigenous people, the theft of, you know, all yeah. of it. It goes on and on. And it and Africa, the continent, gets, you know, we have our former president calling it a shithole and things like this, right? And it was paradise. It was paradise. Yeah. Cameroon was, I've never been anywhere where people were kinder, where people treated each other with loving respect. Cameroon has everything. It has rainforest, it has stunning pristine beaches, it has beautiful clear fresh water. They have absorbed so many folks fleeing political conflict in Nigeria, so many folks from Chad fleeing the water crisis, the climate crisis, because Lake Chad, which was the water source for 20 million people in Africa, right. is almost completely dried up. So the drought has forced mass migrations. And Cameroon is this kind of like gold, it has this sort of incredible resources that keep it very stable. It's surrounded on its inland sides by these rainforesty mountains. Mm. It's, you know, it's got a beautiful port. It's a stunning place, and it's absorbed. It has 124 distinct ethnic groups and languages, and there's no war. Nobody's warring. They use humor to diffuse crisis situations amongst one another, and they've absorbed and welcomed so many refugees from Nigeria and Chad, and it was stunning to me. I remember we were on this little beach, and there were kids like running into the water with these nets and coming out full of these silverfish, and our friend made us grilled us fish over a fire. I mean, it was the most euphoric, idyllic, paradise-like experience I've ever had. And I thought about what the images that we see of Africa here, how skewed and biased it is, because the fact is that all of Europe's wealth, all of the empires, the various colonial empires of Europe, so much of that wealth was extracted and stolen from Africa, including, of course, in America, extracting and stealing black people, my ancestors.
Yeah.
And enrich our unpaid labor and blood and children created the wealth of this country, you know, a vast amount of it. You know, we don't talk about, so I was just thinking about the kind of the depth of the theft that's happened here. Mm. And there I am at this checkpoint, there's a man with a gun, you know, and we're taught that, you know, oh, a black man with a gun, nothing could be more fearsome in this country. You know, the bigotry of this country teaches us that. And this guy just wanted to say, hey, he'd love the show. And it was a $2 fee to drive through the checkpoint. $2. Yeah. I was like, okay, this is bureaucracy I can get behind. You know, I mean, it was just, it completely, and the things, people saying things to me like, we're so sorry. Our village never sold slaves. I had never thought about the African experience of the slave trade. You know, I had never thought about it because we don't talk about that or study that or learn about any of it. We don't learn about the fact that there were incredibly wealthy kingdoms, you know, and that there was, I mean, it's like we don't learn anything about African history, which is world history, which is what the wealth of the European colonial powers was based on. You know, it's just fascinating. And that is part of the erasure of black contributions. And I think it's a very intentional thing because then the guilt sets in if you really face it, right?
Have you considered working for the Cameroonian Tourism Board?
I should, because it was a miracle. It was the most, that was the most miraculous experience that I got to have based on going to play a show. Yeah.
Well, that that song, was it Hi Brazil?
Yes.
Where you talk about your great-grandmother. This album, Outside Child, is sort of like a looking back through your family line. Obviously, some of it forced family, some of it adopted family, but it's all your family, right? Again, it's like this cubist, multi-angle view.
And the great-grandmother, the Scottish great-grandmother, is my biological my mom is a Scottish Canadian, you know, so that part is my lineage too, you know, and there are some really intense parallels between within the lineages, you know, it's really fascinating.
My great-grandmother was a magic weaver, came across the water and caught the fever, wondered if her mother could hear her when she sang the words she learned to say. In the blue Kamani child shimmering still, Dame Kaluna, low lady of the hills, cup of cold sun and a winter pill, send me back on my way. Seven black rabbits of high Brazil, 21 petals of daffodils, 13 note of the black-haired trill, I'll fly home today.
If you could put together a festival where you booked five artists who are no longer on this living plane, who are back in history somewhere, you could have them come alive for one day only, who would those five artists be, and where would it be set? Where would your fest be set?
Oh, that is, well, I think I would, this is a really hard question. I think the festival would be a free festival in the park in Montreal, because that was so important to me growing up, that I got to experience public art, free music growing up, you know, that was accessible to me, because my family, they were never going to take me to a show, you know, that was not something. So the fact that I got to experience that was because of free art. Okay. So it would be a free concert. It would be outdoors in a park in Montreal. Miriam Makeba.
Okay.
I always wanted to see her. I would love, so Miriam Makeba, this is hard. Like any artist, okay. But that is passed on. Miriam Makeba, Prince, Lhasa Isela, Mahalia Jackson.
Mm.
And this is so hard. Who would the fifth be? All right, Miriam Makeba, Prince, Lhasa Isela, Mahalia Jackson, and Odetta.
Yeah, she's right behind you.
She's right behind me. Yeah. So that's who it would be. And it would be a free concert in the park in Montreal. And that would be incredible.
All right, well, can you take us out with one song that you'd like to present from the new record that we haven't talked about? A song that means a lot to you?
Yes, Poison Arrow. It means a lot to me because I think, in a way, it's one of the most hopeful songs on the record. And it's really about reclaiming my city of Montreal. And it's about realizing, you know, after becoming Ida's mom and the kind of years of deprogramming the self-hatred that had been instilled into me, going back to Montreal and being able to introduce the city to my daughter and realizing that I didn't feel fear anymore when I was there, and that I could just love it again, and that I could introduce it to her. And I, the French part, the French part is, je te souhaite la paix, je te souhaite l'acceptance, je te souhaite une deuxième chance, c'est le cœur d'un enfant, routier, routier, chanter, chanter, l'heure des miracles est arrivée, le poison peut être médecin, si t'en bois une goutte seulement. And it basically means, I wish for you peace, I wish for you acceptance, I wish for you to have the wonder of a child in your heart, to be like a child in your heart. Mm. We're all travelers, sing, you know, we move through these troubles, and the drops of poison, a drop of poison can also be medicine, or poison can also be medicine if we only drink a drop. And a kind of understanding that we are not defined by what we've lost, and we're not defined by the scars we carry, and we're not defined by what anyone did to us against our will. You know, we are defined by how we move past it, by the people we choose to be in our community, by the ways that we open our hearts and connect. And, you know, we are defined by our resilience, in fact. Like, that's our human birthright. It's our human birthright. We are all, it doesn't matter what your individual heritage is, we're one human family, and we are descended, all of us, from long lines of people who survived against all odds and who lived through times harder than these.
Poison arrow, be kind to me, and I'll be kind to you. It's not just your poison, it's the bow, the string, shaft and feather too. The rush of the wind, the blue sky burn, the rain that soaked the ground to give thee oleander love. Go in peace, be not afraid.
There you have it, Miss Allison Russell, everybody. You can go to AllisonRussellMusic.com for her newest record, Outside Child. It is nominated for 3 Grammy Awards. And as you may have heard earlier in the episode, you can go back to our first season and listen to the wonderful episode we taped with her and her husband JT, aka the Birds of Chicago, one of my favorite groups of all time. We recorded it right in my bedroom, and they play a really cool duet called Super Lover. You can check that video out on our Instagram at Show on the Road Music. And for many episodes, we actually upload the entire conversation of us talking over the airways. You can check that out, Show on the Road, on YouTube. I want to send a quick congratulations to Amy and the Bluegrass Situation team for their 10th anniversary, which they're celebrating this week. There's a really cool article about Allison Russell on the BGS website with her banjo and best friends. Allison Russell delivers Outside Child in 2 parts. Really cool article, so please check that out. You may be thinking to yourself, wow, this podcast can be accessed for free anywhere I want at any time. How can I contribute to make this podcast more possible in the future? Well, if you look at the text of this podcast on Apple, you'll see that you can donate on Red Circle directly to this podcast, $4.99, or any bigger amount like $1 million that you're feeling at the moment. I indeed have a new baby on the way. Not me personally, my wife will be giving birth at any moment. I'm waiting for the word. So if you want to help me do this podcast through this crazy journey I'm on, please contribute and also buy merch from my group Dustbowl Revival. We'll be at the Wiltern, as I mentioned, March 31st in LA. And which episodes are coming up, you ask? Well, we have my talk with Grammy winner Keb Moe, my talk with the crazy frontman of St. Paul and the Broken Bones, Paul Janeway, from his house in Alabama, and a wonderful talk with the duo Penny and Sparrow. If you have a suggestion of who I should talk to this season, please send a note on Instagram at Show on the Road Podcast. And as always, the Show on the Road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Zach Lupitin, and we are a part of the BGS Podcast Network. And now, I give you my assistant editor, Sunny, as she snores into the mic next to me.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.